Listen online or download from the RN website.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas across Australia on RN and online at abc.net.au/RN. I'm Paul Barclay. In the last few years, a number of so-called peer-to-peer sharing companies have absolutely boomed, disrupting some very well-established industries. Based online, these are companies like Airbnb, where people advertise spare rooms and houses for short-term rent, much to the horror of hotel chains and some local councils. Uber, the ride-sharing company that's upsetting the taxi industry, and Freelancer, which connects employees and businesses around the world, often for quite small tasks, but which has been accused of offshoring jobs. It's not just traditional industries facing challenges from this new economy. Governments too around the world are struggling to regulate in a way that strikes a balance between protecting consumers and existing competition laws with encouraging efficiency and innovation. Tonight, we're at the Grattan Institute in Melbourne for a discussion on regulating the peer-to-peer economy. The event is moderated by Jim Minifee, Productivity Growth Program Director at Grattan, and the guests are David Plouffe, Senior Vice President of Policy and Strategy for Uber. David's former career was in politics, and he is widely referred to as the architect of President Obama's two presidential campaign victories. Matt Barry is CEO of the very successful company Freelancer. He's also adjunct associate professor at the Department of Electrical and Information Engineering at the University of Sydney. And with a regulator's perspective, Stephen King, professor of economics and co-director of the Business Policy Forum at Monash University in Melbourne, as well as chair of the WA Economic Regulation Authority. He's a former member of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. We kick off with David Plouffe, the CEO of Uber.
I thought I'd start off by asking, how many of you, show of hand, have used Uber or a service like it? Good amount. I'll do a little less remedial then. But I thought I'd just start off for those of you who haven't used it or aren't familiar with it. So Uber, it actually started out, the idea was born in Paris by our two co-founders, but the service started in San Francisco. And it certainly wasn't meant to be a big idea. It was just an idea for it to make sure a group of friends could push a button and get a ride, because they were frustrated by the transportation service at the moment in Paris and in San Francisco. So the way Uber works is you download an app, Android or iPhone, and you press a button. And you know, here in Melbourne, it's less than 3 minutes. In most cities, it's 2, 3, 4 minutes. Driver comes. You've already preloaded your credit card, so there's no cash payment. You put in a destination and tell the driver where you're going, and they take you there. And so it's basically, I think why it took off is it's consistent with how people are living the rest of their lives. You know, they're banking that way, they're doing research that way, they're staying in touch that way, they're, that's how they keep up with the world. A lot of work is done now on smartphones. I mean, here in Australia, it's the second, I think, highest smartphone penetration in the world, a place that invented Wi-Fi. You know, so there's so much early adoption of innovation here in Australia, so we think it's a particularly great market for Uber. But it was just consistent with how people lived their lives. And so what you're seeing, we're now in 283 cities around the world, in over 50 countries. Australia is one of our largest markets internationally and really growing. And it just started out as an idea of convenience, basically. And I think what's happened is you see uptake around the world where, here in the state of Victoria, we've already have over 2,500 drivers. And, you know, the new government that just came into power, I think they had a pledge of 10,000 drivers. And we think we're going to contribute a lot of that number, because we have every week in Australia more than 100 drivers who apply to be on the Uber platform. And first of all, the drivers, to fill you in a little bit on them, you know, it's a little bit different than traditional transportation. Some have obviously been professional drivers. We have plenty, actually, who've come over who might have driven for taxi. Some still drive for taxi full-time and drive a few hours on Uber. But it's also a lot of people who may be students. They may be retirees. It may be a stay-at-home parent. It may be someone who's caring for an elder parent. And it gives them complete control in a way that's very unique in our economy, meaning, so usually a car they own. Cars are only utilized 4% of the time, by the way, so it's an underutilized asset. They decide when they're going to drive, how long they're going to drive, if they're going to drive. They press a button, they go on the platform. They may drive for a few hours, they may drive for an hour. They may say, today my goal is to make $50, and they make it in an hour and a half, and they turn it off. So it's complete control. And so it is probably the most flexible way out there to either make a full income, and our drivers bring home a lot of money comparatively, but also to supplement income. And so I think what you're starting to see around the world is, in the beginning, it wasn't too long ago that Uber was a strange idea. It still may be to some people. Now you've had over 25 cities around the world actually pass forward-looking regulations to take into account ride sharing. Well, obviously, we have competitors, but that would allow Uber and our competitors to, and what's great about it is it enshrines in law things like background check regimes, other safety regimes, inspections, insurance. And so it lifts up the whole industry in many places. You know, the taxi industry is still going to be very viable in cities, but it gives more opportunity to those taxi drivers. What we see, for instance, in San Francisco, people will be driving for a taxi company. They'll be driving for Uber. They may be driving for our competitor Lyft. It just gives them multiple opportunity to make the most money, whichever service is going to allow them to make the most living. But you also see the other benefits, which is reduction in drunk driving. Now, people don't have to make a plan, a designated driver. They just press a button, and they're not driving home drunk, which protects them and other people on the road. It's cutting down on distracted driving, which is something that's particularly a problem with younger people. You're seeing real public safety benefit because every ride is GPS tracked, and so we're able to cooperate with law enforcement when there are incidents. We're starting to discuss with municipalities job training programs because it's a really easy way for people. Here in Victoria, if we over-index in terms of where our drivers come from in places of high unemployment. So that's another place. We have a lot of people who this may be their second job, it may be their professional driver. We have a lot of people lose their job. But they have a car payment, they have a mortgage, and this allows them, after they've gone through a background check, to get on the road and make real money. So I think what you're starting to see around the world is elected officials and regulators are seeing, okay, this new service can complement the taxi service, public transportation, people obviously still driving themselves. We also think ultimately it's going to have a huge impact on congestion and emissions. We have a product we're really excited about. It's a carpooling product called Uber Pool, and it's now operating in San Francisco, Paris, and New York. And we hope to bring it to as many cities as we can. And what that means is, if you're going, let's say you are to go from here to the airport, let's say, or here across the city, you're basically able to go for half price of what an UberX ride would be. So if you're going in, let's say I see that exit sign back there. If I'm going to that exit sign, and one of you in the second row is going to the same direction, and you're within 2 minutes, so it can't take you out of your way, but you say, I'd like to Uber pool if someone can match with me. You hop in that car, and you're basically going in the same destination. So it's much less expensive for you to take that ride. The driver makes a lot more money because they're always on a trip. A lot of professional drivers aren't driving, you know, 60 minutes out of 60 minutes. They're driving 10, 12 minutes. This keeps our drivers really, really busy. And that's really when you see the effect of taking cars off the road and reducing congestion. And basically every city in the world is dealing with an epidemic of congestion. And it's only going to get worse. Some people have described it by the middle of the next decade, the world's going to be facing a Carmageddon. So every municipality is thinking about, how can we get more cars off the road? And with Uber Pool, you begin to see that. In San Francisco, we're really starting to see a lot of people who might have taken traditional UberX, which is just somebody driving a Prius, or Uber Black, which is the more the luxury black car service. Now they're Uber Pooling because it's basically maybe takes them an extra minute or two, but they're able to save money. There's a good social dynamic, and a lot of people feel good about contributing to lower congestion. So we're really excited about that project in terms of our vision, and we think we're going to bring that to a lot of cities in the coming months and years. So we're excited about the future, and obviously we want to work with governments in a cooperative way about a way forward. And I think that what that requires is most transportation regulations were written well before cell phone technologies, flat screen TVs, cable TV, smartphones. They didn't envision these types of technologies and service. And so what we've been able to do around the world is really have regulators and elected officials look for how can we refashion regulations in a way. And I think there's been a little bit of a misconception out there that, you know, Uber doesn't want to be regulated, and we do. I mean, we're in the room every day trying to help governments figure out how to move forward in a smart way with modern regulations that, you know, don't have a lot of barriers to entry so people can get on the road and start making money, that really does provide competition. And choice. So consumers have choice. It's one more choice in terms of how they get around their city. But drivers then have choice.
Well, Matt, let's move on. You run a very different business in terms of its subject matter, but some of the underlying platform characteristics are the same. So tell us a bit about Freelancer.
So what we do is we run the world's largest online freelancing and crowdsourcing marketplace. And it basically, in layman's terms, it's eBay for jobs. We connect up 14.4 million people all around the planet. Fundamentally, two types of entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs who are small businesses, and we help them turn their that spark of an idea about, you know, building a business or creating a business or changing a business or building a new product or service with an online workforce to actually turn that dream into reality. And we take away the time, the cost, and the hassle of getting that done, right? Because there's people all around the world that can do the job for you any time of day. And we also empower entrepreneurs in the developing world, and these are people who are, as the internet's proliferating through the developing world, going online and raising their income levels by working in technical jobs that are otherwise, for the most part, unavailable to them in the location they're in. And so, fundamentally, there's a number of, you know, really big global macro themes that I think maybe will resonate through tonight's talk. But the themes that we built Freelancer on. The fact that, you know, it's pretty hard to understand this, but there's 7.1 billion people on the planet. 4 billion people are not connected yet, right? So most of the world's population, 60% of the world's population, have not joined the internet. But they're coming in at a dramatic pace. They're coming in at, you know, double-digit rates. Already, if you look at the top 10 U.S. consumer internet websites globally, 81% of the traffic is non-U.S. traffic. So it's coming from, you know, all around the world, not from the U.S. The internet started very much in the U.S., but now it's a lot more inclusive. Online education is proliferating around the world. So if you have an internet connection, no matter where you live, if it's in the Philippines or Bangladesh or Vietnam, you can now go online and access a very low cost, high quality education. So you can self-train and self-tool yourself. And fundamentally, what we're doing is we're allowing people to come along and go online and basically increase the prosperity in their lives by working in jobs for anyone all around the world. We're an Australian company. We floated on the Australian Securities Exchange November of 2013. We are very much like Uber in the fact we're an online marketplace, right? So where buyers and sellers come together and get things done. And I think fundamentally, just to kind of maybe explain a little bit for a minute or two about the sharing economy and what the sharing economy or the rental economy or the collaborative economy basically is that due to advances in the internet and in software and devices like mobile phones, it's allowed more efficient utilization of resources and even more importantly, more efficient marshalling of those resources, right? So, you know, people have, you know, I think Dave mentioned that people have, you know, cars sitting around in their garage all day used 4% of the time. Well, with Uber, you can get those cars out there and get them more efficient, and as a result, solve a lot of problems around, you know, pollution, congestion, you know, and so on. With Freelancer, there's people around the world with all sorts of different skill sets, but they may be stuck in a certain location where there's no jobs available in that particular area. So let's say I want to be an expert in, you know, mobile phone app development for healthcare, right? And I'm somewhere in Bangladesh. There's probably no jobs for me. And if there are jobs, they're very, very low paying. But now I can go online. I can work for, you know, a global client base, and I can actually go find a job and work in that particular area. Or maybe I'm retired. I used to be an accountant, and I worked a full time job. Now I live out in the country somewhere. Now I can go online. And I can work as an accountant, and maybe one day a week or 2 days a week, and so forth. Or, you know, maybe I'm young. I'm studying at school, and I have a few hours here or there, kind of to fill in time. Either maybe I'm starting a business on the side and have a bit of sort of passive cash flow coming in. I can do that very, very low cost now because we remove the time, the hassle, and the cost of going and starting your own business. Or maybe I can, if there's a skill set I want to work in, I can go work in that skill set. you know, for people who want to change careers, maybe you know you're stuck in a job that you really hate, 9 to 5. You can't really make the big leap into a new career, you know, instantly because you've got no experience. But maybe on the side, on the weekends, and maybe after hours, you can kind of you know play in a new area and learn a new skill set and kind of work online and kind of build it up and earn an income at the same time. So, you know, we're doing a whole bunch of, I think, a lot of good around the world. You know, in the Western world, primarily our users are employers. They're people who hire people to get things done. Typically, you're a small business owner. They're a cafe owner. They want to build a website. They're busy all day. They don't have a lot of money. You know, they look around. They try and get a web designer to kind of help them, you know, to design a website. Maybe cost them $5,000 or $10,000. They can't really afford that. But maybe they could afford, you know, $300 or $400. Right, so we really help them kind of, you know, go online and actually grow their business and compete in the modern world, which is hyper competitive and hyper connected, and you know really in the developing world, it's really helping people get work. And so, you know, in terms of policy issues, kind of really affecting the space, you know. You know, there's obviously, you know, the internet's quite disruptive and new business models are disruptive, etc. And I think, you know, there in particular in the sharing economy, there's a lot of regulation that exists that's kind of archaic and it's old and it's belonged to a time before the internet, a time before we had mobile phones and before, you know, software came along and was, you know, in everyone's sort of hands. And I think that a lot of that regulation is just outdated. Now, of course, anytime the government kind of, well, a lot of the time the government comes in and kind of tries to set rules in certain industries and certain ways in which things need to be done, it can create discontinuities and kind of distortions in the market where, you know, incumbents who are protected by that regulation, you know, maybe can reap the benefit of that and windfall profits as a result. And then when something new comes along kind of threatens that, there's obviously a lot of vested interests that kind of come out of the woodwork to kind of say, well, no, this is really bad for A, B, C, D, E, F, G. But at the end of the day, you know, the sharing economy is all about better use of resources, better marshalling of those resources, and that leads to a whole bunch of really positive benefits for economies globally, whether it's Uber, whether it's Airbnb, whether it's something like Freelancer, or any of the other many other models that have kind of come up. And you know, the great thing about the world today with the internet is the rate of innovation is fantastic, and as a result of that, you can deliver products and services to market a lot quicker that are fantastic services. I mean, you know, I used Uber for the first time a couple of years ago. And let me tell you, I was hooked. I mean, this is a service that is so much better than what's out there. It is just so much easier to get a car. You pull out a phone, you hit a button, and you can see the car arriving. I was one of the first guys to sign up for Uber for Business, and they said, well, come around and we'll kind of do a little thing. And I said, oh, could I actually sign up as an UberX driver? And that'd be kind of fun. And I actually filled in the application form and I was rejected. And I have a very nice new car. But the problem was when I was a student in 1991, I lost my license for 3 months for speeding. And as a result, you know, a little bit over the limit. And as a result, I'm banned from being an Uber driver. So it's kind of like, it's a little bit frustrating.
And for the how great our background checks were. So. And we got that on film, I think.
Well, anyway, yeah, you can use that on the film.
Matt, but, you know, can I ask whether you qualify on your own platform?
My platform's a little bit different. I have root access to my platform. But I don't pass a lot of the certificate. We have a self-certifying system and a self-governance system on freelancers. So the way it works is, luckily, we don't really experience a lot of regulation because most of our jobs are small jobs. They're cross-border, so someone overseas is doing a small job for you. It lasts maybe a few days or a few hours or a week or two. I mean, the main issues we have around regulation is getting payments to someone. So getting a payment to someone in Bangladesh or a payment to someone in India, and all around the world, you've got to deal with all these different countries and all the regulations that change every day on that respect. But you know, the way that our marketplace works is the more jobs you do, the better the job you do, the more you get paid, and the better the feedback is from the users, you crowdsource the feedback, the higher you gain what we call reputation. And that reputation builds over time, and that determines how high you appear when you bid on a job in the organic listings or when you're in the directory. And we order you from the top to the bottom. The top guy has done the most jobs, been paid the most, got the best feedback. The guy at the bottom is unrated, basically. We don't know anything about that person. If you do something really bad, like something egregious, Then it goes to a support team, and you know, we're looking to potentially kick someone off the platform, as Uber does, and all the other online marketplaces do as well. But you know, it's the whole thing about self-governance, it's self-regulating, and the great thing about the sharing economy is that it's really driven down the cost of actually finding resources, transacting with those resources, whether it's staffing or cars or houses or whatever it may be, and ultimately, I think it's better for everyone.
Well, that's the sell proposition, and I'm sure that we'll be able to take the devil's advocate questions further, but thank you, Matt. Now, Stephen, you're I hesitate to say a regulator at heart, but you've thought pretty hard about the right role for regulation. It'd be terrific to hear your thoughts about what role regulators might have in this brave new world.
Okay, thanks, Jim. I guess let me start by saying, I think Uber, Freelancer, Airbnb, they are just great. They are transforming the economy. But my role here is to be the wet blanket. And so I'm going to, you've had the flames of passion that we've seen in the last few minutes. I'm going to turn them into a bit of smoke. Because there's at least three concerns that we need to deal with from a public policy and a regulatory perspective with the peer-to-peer economy, the sharing economy, these new services. And they are, how do they fit into our competition laws and regulations? How do they fit into our consumer laws and regulations? And how do they fit in with incumbents? So let me run through those three. Now, first off, let me start off on the competition side. The key thing to realise about the peer-to-peer economy, the sharing economy, is that we have seen lots of this before. So there are similar services that have been around that have raised the same sort of issues for a long time. Credit cards, for example, are a classic example of a platform that raises those issues, merchants on one side, consumers on the other, the banks and the systems in the middle. Shopping centres are another classic example of a platform. They bring together a range of retailers and they bring together the consumers. When you reach into your pocket, you can choose Visa, MasterCard, NAB, Westpac, whoever it happens to be, you've got a choice there in real time. And so does the merchant. Almost every merchant takes a range of credit cards, maybe not all of them, but they'll take a range. That's multi-homing. Tipping. How many of you remember the Yellow Pages? Put up your hand if you remember the Yellow Pages. Yeah, there's enough old people here. Thank you. Yellow Pages was a paper directory, and there was only one of them, despite attempts to enter, because there was a tipping effect. All businesses wanted to be in the Yellow Pages. Why? Because all consumers looked at the Yellow Pages. All consumers looked at the Yellow Pages. Why? Because that's where all the businesses were. Now, they raise competition issues. Why? Tipping leads to market power. If Uber's there, if Lyft is there, and there are a whole bunch of alternatives, that's great, because Uber will be kept honest by the competition. But if Uber are the only guys out there with a ride-sharing service, it's not going to be too long. You know, David may have walked under a bus, because I'm sure he's well-meaning, but his successors may not be as well-meaning. They may say, damn, I've got a profit opportunity here. Let's push up the prices. Everybody's with us. All the drivers have to be on Uber because that's where all the customers go. All the customers have to be on Uber because that's where all the drivers are. You've tipped. The other sort of competition issues that we deal with in these platforms, and we've seen them. For example, why did Aldi have such problems coming into Australia? Because there were exclusive arrangements between the shopping centres and, guess who, Coles and Woolworths. They disappeared after the 2009 ACCC inquiry because of pressure put on them. If we see those same sort of exclusivity arrangements coming out of Uber or Freelancer or Airbnb or TripAdvisor and so on, we have a problem. So if Uber allows their drivers to multi-home, to be an Uber driver and a Lyft driver and perhaps a regular hire car or taxi driver, that helps get rid of a problem. But if they don't, we may have a problem going forward. Second one, consumer concerns. There's a real issue here, and it's already sort of partly come up in our discussions, about who is responsible and who is liable for issues relating to consumers. It's fine to talk about self-regulation. I was in India over the new year, and there was a rape in Delhi. by an Uber driver. The driver was caught rapidly because of Uber's processes. But that's one rape too many. If it's security issues, no matter what service you have for providing rides. But the question is Uber responsible for that rape? Or is somebody else responsible? It's not just an economic question. It's not just a moral question. It's also a political question. Because the politicians have to deal with the pressure. So who is liable? For example, if Google runs misleading and deceptive ads, are they liable for those advertisements? Channel 9 isn't liable if it runs a misleading and deceptive advertisement because it is a publisher. Is Google a publisher? The ACCC brought an action against Google. On that basis, there was no doubt the ads were misleading and deceptive because the advertisers had rolled over already and paid the fines. Google fought that all the way to the High Court. The High Court decided Google was an advertiser. They were not responsible. Interestingly, TripAdvisor has had effectively the reverse in Italy. TripAdvisor was found guilty of misleading and deceptive behaviour because they could not guarantee that the advice provided, the reviews, were independent, and the claim was that TripAdvisor were claiming they were independent. So they were found to be guilty in Italy. We've had Google in Europe being told that they're responsible for the content on websites that can be found through their search engines if that information relates to an individual and that individual believes that that information is no longer relevant to them. The right to be forgotten decision. I think that's a mad decision. So we have the law being created in real time. We have to ask who is responsible and how do we deal with real legitimate issues of safety. And I think there's a range of legal issues here that simply cannot be left to the market. I'd love it if the markets worked so well, the reputations worked so well, that we did not have to have any consumer protection law. But we have hundreds of years of experience showing that that is not reality. And even if you doubt the economics of that, the political reality says you will have these regulations. The third part I want to talk about is the incumbents. It's really easy for us to get up here, and Matt's done it, and say, you know, we've got outdated, outmoded regulation. If you're somebody who's paid $250,000, let's go back before the Fells inquiry. If you're someone in Victoria who paid $500,000 for a taxi licence, that was the price about 4 or 5 years ago before the Fells inquiry. And Uber comes along, the government changes the rules, and your licence now becomes worthless? Is there a moral responsibility there? I don't know. It's a tough question. I'm an economist who's been involved in at least two different taxi industry inquiries recommending deregulation. And every time, the key question is, that's fine, but what do you do about the people who have just bought a taxi license, who have sunk their life savings into buying this business and you're about to make it worthless? That's a real question. That's why we still have taxi regulation here and in many countries around the world, because that's a question that is really hard to answer. So getting rid of regulation, allowing these guys in, is great. It is an improvement to the economy. There will be growth, there will be more jobs, there will be better utilisation of capital. All of that is true. But do we have an obligation to look after the incumbents? And what are the incumbents going to do? They're not going to take this stuff lying down. They're going to be out there fighting a legal battle as well as out there on the streets. And the legal battle can hurt. Just ask Napster. We often talk about first mover advantage. In these areas where you're fighting incumbents who have hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars in many cases tied up in these industries, they will fight you through the courts. And they will fight you, hopefully, until they win. From their perspective, Napster was bankrupted by various legal suits by copyright owners. We could argue that copyright laws, things like the Disneyland exemptions, are pretty silly. But the first mover got wiped out. I'm not sure if Uber's going to do a Napster at any time soon. So we also have to think about the incumbents and the regulation and whether we are responsible for them.
That was Stephen King, Professor of Economics at Monash and Chair of the WA Economic Regulation Authority. Paul Barclay with you for Big Ideas on RN and online. Tonight, we're at the Grattan Institute talking about the peer-to-peer economy and how to regulate it. Back to the discussion now with David Plouffe from Uber.
You know, we just had ride-sharing regulations pass in Calcutta, India. We're making a lot of progress in Manila. In Thailand, we've had good discussions here in Victoria. But the rest of the world is basically a year and a half behind where the United States was. So a year ago, there wasn't a single city, even in the United States, that had passed ride-sharing regulations. Not a single one. And now you've had over 25. You know, most of our major cities, we've got regulations in California, in Chicago, in Boston, in Washington, D.C., in cities in Texas. Elected officials in those major cities say, well, wait, this is a lot of jobs. I mean, in many cases, you're seeing, like in Washington, D.C., we have over 11,000 drivers. In Chicago, over 15,000. Even in big cities like that, that's like a massive company just dropping into the city and setting shop. And given our growth projections, we're only going to see that increase. So they see where people are struggling with both job creation and income opportunity. This is a terrific thing for the city. And the truth is, to most people, Uber is not a tech company in San Francisco. Uber is the local drivers and riders. It is that local marketplace. And so I think what's happened is elected officials and regulators have heard from our drivers and from our very passionate rider base. And we have almost 200,000 people signed up for our platform here in Victoria alone. You hear from people in the business community who say, I've got more customers now because Uber is dropping them off there, particularly if not on a public transportation line. You see people who care about public transportation saying, wait, we see a lot of the trips begin and end at public transportation. Uber has a great, and our competitors have a great last mile effect. So this is not a zero-sum game, that Uber and services like it are a complement to people who are pedestrians, to public transportation, to people who use taxi, to people who drive themselves. But you know, I think particularly for young people in urban cores, a lot of them aren't purchasing vehicles. And so it gives them a great opportunity.
Matt, let me ask you a question. Do you feel that you've got market power that needs to be regulated? Come on, you've got 14 million people.
There are 3 billion people on the internet. We're a minnow at this point, absolute minnow. Right? A question about this regulation stuff. I think people have to ask themselves, what sort of world do they really want to live in? Because it's just... We're in Australia. I'll talk about the Australian example. It's just I've just been overseas. I came back from the UK, and we are just so regulated in this country now. It is just out of control. If you try and sell, it's illegal now to sell an egg at a market unless it's stamped by a national egg regulator. I didn't know there was a massive problem in eggs, but somehow someone decided this is good legislation. I think it's illegal to sell a boat on a Sunday in South Australia. I love coming down to Melbourne and Victoria because some special little bureaucrat in New South Wales or series of bureaucrats have decided to tell you what time of day you can go out at night time, what size glass you can drink out of, what the glass is made of, what liquid you can pour it at what times of night, and that changes over the course of the night, what time you need to go home. I was just in the UK. People were outside a pub, parked the wrong way in the street, drinking out of a glass, went across the street, came back, and no one died, right? It's just, and I come back here, and it's just, I had some guys come up from Hong Kong recently. It's just, it's illegal to have a scotch on the rocks in Sydney now after midnight. In the city of Sydney, illegal to have a scotch on the rocks after midnight. It's just nuts, right? It's out of control, right? Anyway, that's my little tirade about regulation, and I can go forever. Fundamentally, some of your arguments, right? You said, these marketplaces get big. Well, yeah, online marketplaces do tend towards winner takes all, right? And buyers go where the sellers go where the buyers are. The reason why is they become more efficient. I want to find a Hungarian translator with experience in the automotive industry to do an app for me, right? The bigger the marketplace is, the better it is to actually find someone, the easier it is to find someone, right? So they do tend towards that. Yeah, there's a bit of sparring the other day. Google's invested a huge amount of money in Uber, and they're saying they're going to come out with their own service, right? You know, who knows? Maybe Apple will come out with their own service. It's a highly competitive world, and I don't think we need a lot of regulation to come along and just stifle innovation.
Stephen, right of reply would seem to be in order.
Okay, I suspect some of our biggest companies, when they were starting off, would have said, "Look, we're small. You know, what's the problem?" And the problem doesn't necessarily exist today. But the problem exists when you become large, when the tipping occurs, and you control your own rules. And I mean, Freelancer, for example, controls its own rules. It was a really nice interview. Talk about the rules that you have on Freelancer with regards to being able to bid for jobs. And the idea of it, well, you don't want it to be run down to the guy who's willing to do it for 5 cents an hour, but that wouldn't be a good outcome. So you've got a different process to some of the other platforms.
But the market doesn't work like that. I mean, people go for quality. They go for the service they want delivered, right? It's not like lowest cost wins.
But all I'm getting at is you've got current rules on Freelancer, which actually control the way people can bid on Freelancer.
Yeah, but they're the rules that we've set.
Of course.
If we didn't do a good job self-regulating ourselves or self-governing ourselves, then people wouldn't use our service.
Okay, let's say that we've tipped to Freelancer and Freelancer's wiped everyone else out. What's to stop you changing your own rules?
That's just such a fantasy world. It's just like, I would love it to happen. It's never going to happen, right? Like, okay, what is it, like 7 billion people have to work through?
Okay, so let's say Uber in Melbourne. Sorry, Jim, I'm taking your spot. Let's say Uber in Melbourne is now the dominant ride-sharing platform. Lyft hasn't come in. Lyft is about to come in. You change the rules and say, well, sorry, if you're an Uber driver, you can't be on Lyft. As soon as you're on Lyft, we exclude you from being a driver. There is no law stopping that. There is no contract stopping that. We rely on your goodwill. And I'm sure you have goodwill at the moment. Your successors may not.
Yeah. No, I mean, listen, I think that what makes this so attractive for drivers, and that's not going to change, is they have ultimate control, just like the passenger does. And I think I come at this from a unique perspective. I worked for a Democratic president in the United States. And, in our country, that means you are a believer in all things regulation, according to the opposition. And, you know, I was involved in, President Obama said, I want to look through all the regulations on the books in the entire government. And it was fascinating. You know, and I actually believe as a progressive, if you believe that there are rules that make sense in smart regulations, you're the first person that has an obligation when one doesn't make sense or is outdated to raise your hand. And we found hundreds of them. Things like different agencies regulated cheese pizza and pepperoni pizza. And, spilled milk was treated like an oil spill in some places. A lot of it made sense at the time. And so I do think it's very important for government, and this is hard to do. I worked in government. But to stay ahead of the curve a little bit and to have regulations that, yes, protect consumers and, yes, enshrine in things like safety, but make sure that it doesn't throttle the ability for people to make a living. And so I think at the end of the day, listen, we're going to have competition all over the world. We already do. There's only going to be more of it. And that means that it's going to keep us on our toes, and we have to deliver both our driver partners and our riders. But I think that is something that across the world you are starting to see regulators and elected officials really wrestle with, it, particularly in the transportation space. I mean, we have some cities around the world that have things like return to garage. What does that mean? That means if someone's out and they take a fare to a hotel or a business, they've got to go back to their base before they pick up another fare. It makes no sense at all. We're actually okay with, and not just okay with, but are seeking a regulatory pathway forward with local governments, but in a way that does not stifle the ability to make a living, that's good for consumers, that's good for the local economy. You've got huge economic imperative to actually add to income and create jobs. You've got a huge imperative to make transportation more safe. Cities have to say yes to this, and more of them are.
Let me add just a few more of the implemented or proposed rules that ride-sharing has been presented with. Cap the number of rideshare cars on the road. 24-hour window on pre-booking. In other words, you cannot book within 24 hours. Make booking rideshare by GPS illegal. Cars have to be newer than 4 years. No drop-offs at the airport. Ban surge pricing. Minimum time for a ride in a private car is 1 hour. Now, all of these rules would have the effect of protecting incumbents, but all of them are very, very inefficient. And I think there are lessons that we can derive from successful processes of microeconomic reform, both in Australia and elsewhere, about how to get the efficiency upside while still achieving an acceptable outcome in terms of distribution or the transition for the incumbents. Stephen, what are the lessons you would draw from Australia's microeconomic reforms in the 90s about how to get that efficiency dividend without giving up on the people who happen to be caught in the crossfire?
Okay, so First, we can all come up with our silly regulations. There are lots and lots of silly regulations. The question here isn't about whether we support a whole bunch of silly regulations or regulations that involve vested interests and incumbents trying to stop Uber from competing. The question is, what are the appropriate regulations for Uber, for Freelancer, for Airbnb, for a range of these different platforms that are emerging? And we've got to make sure that we don't stop them emerging, because you're dead right. This is a positive-sum game. There are overall winners from this process. But we have to work out the best way to ensure that, you know, the guys who become the ultimate winners don't start making the rest of us losers. And that's a threat. Now, maybe we can leave it to competition law. Answering Jim's question, there are a whole bunch of areas where we can say, look, we just have general rules about market power and about taking advantage of market power, about mergers, creating market power, and maybe we can just leave the sharing economy there. Maybe we can say, okay, look, Freelancer, yeah, the chances are that you're not going to dominate the world. If you do, then we'll worry about you then, and we've got general laws to deal with that. The lessons are, some stuff we can leave to the general competition laws. And yeah, Freelancer, I probably think you're one of those. Other stuff, we've seen experiments of the total deregulation, and we've said actually that doesn't actually work very well. And we need to think a bit more carefully about what the regulations have to be. So we've got experience from around the world.
Let me just push a little harder, though, because 1 in 100 startups is a success. So what, to you, is an acceptable return on equity for the ones that do get there? And there's a different way to think about competition, which is not we've got to drive everybody down to their absolute marginal ex post opportunity cost. The view would be, let's make sure that we get rapid innovation, and that's going to result in some ex post, quote-unquote, monopoly rents. But thought about in a dynamic context, you'd be all for those because that is what drives innovation. So, you know, to my mind, any quote-unquote monopoly rents I'm seeing in the ride-sharing or other sectors looks like pretty much part of that dynamic efficiency.
Yeah, so if Uber gets monopoly rents because the customers love it, the drivers love it, but there's nothing stopping the drivers and the customers from saying, you know what, Uber's sort of raised its prices. It's not providing as good a service. We're going across to Lyft. If they're making money, then good on them, because they're making money out of competing better than anyone else. But if Uber starts doing things such as saying, gosh, Lyft is on the way in, an Uber driver cannot be a Lyft driver, and I recognise that's not the case at the moment. Okay, so I'm not saying this is the case, I'm dealing with a hypothetical. But it's a hypothetical that may arise in the future. And as soon as they step over the law, the line there, then there is a legal issue that they have to face. They are abusing market power, and that is a regulation that is out there to protect Australian businesses and Australian consumers and make sure that it is a positive-sum game.
I mean, I just think at the end of the day, we're kind of looking a little bit at sort of ghosts in the shadows. I mean, I think that this is a marketplace, and the riders will vote based on where they're getting the best service, where they feel the safest, where they like the drivers the best, where they get the best price, where the wait time's the least. And the drivers are obviously, and are right now, as Matt said, many of them here in Victoria. If you go to the U.S., you land at San Francisco Airport, a lot of them are driving Uber, Lyft, taxi. And again, let's look at where the world was not too long ago. These drivers didn't have any other option. Now they have a lot of different options. And there also was a barrier to letting people in the barrier to being in the transportation sector was extraordinarily high. Now, someone who's got a car, might have lost their job, needs a little extra money, they pass a background check, they get on the road. Now, if they're not doing a good job, they're not going to get good ratings. They may not stay on the road. So that is something that should be, I think, nourished. Because, again, we're at a place right now where one of the central economic challenges facing almost every country is how do we get incomes up?
Look, you can't fight progress, and you can't fight technology, and you can't fight the internet, right? And I just wish we lived in a world, in a country, where the debate amongst people in government and our political leaders was, how can we, you know, terraform the economy to, you know, be more proactive around technology, innovation, science, engineering, you know, all these sort of things, what we can do in this country as opposed to what we can't. And every day, let me tell you, every day, and living in Sydney, it's a very special place because every day there's a new regulation on what I can and cannot do. There is just so many things that we can do with this amazing explosion in innovation and technology that's out there that I really think that, you know, government needs to step back. The sharing economy is all about better utilization of resources, lowering the costs, better marshalling of those resources. It's great in so many different ways. I think the bigger issues are, well, what happens in the world down the track? And it is going to happen, whether people like it or not. It will happen. You know, in terms of how do you, you know, reskill the economy, right, so that all the people involved in, you know, jobs in transportation, et cetera, and so forth, actually move into other jobs. Because, you know, all technology does create, you know, it does disrupt, does take jobs away down the track, but also will create new jobs. And I think that, you know, they're the broader issues. You know, I post a job for a computer science graduate, and I get maybe one or two applicants a day come through, and I'm home by the metric ton. I posted a job for an office manager. I had like 350 applications per day coming through. Right. The first thing I saw when I got the office manager applications was, wow, I don't really want to look through all these CVs. The second thing I thought was, well, gee, I wouldn't want to be an office manager. And the third thing I thought was, well, who's going to retrain all these office managers to go out there and, you know, do something new, right? And I think you know, the bigger issue is down the track. We should be really thinking about not you know, in terms of GDP of the economy, not the old world industries, but what the new world industries are and how we can move the economy towards that.
Two responses. Okay, first off, whilst I've been running a theoretical with Uber and Freelancer up here, it's not actually theory in the real world, because we have seen Google in court in Europe and in Australia. We have seen TripAdvisor in court in Europe. We have seen, for example, in Australia, internet mergers stopped by the ACCC. Now, whether you think they were right or wrong, they stopped, for example, Car Sales and the Trading Post merging because they felt they were the two biggest internet platforms. The ACCC stopped that. So we are actually seeing these issues real time, in real life, in Australia and around the world. So, yeah, you guys don't have market power at the moment, or I'd be amazed if you did in any country where you're operating, but you may have it tomorrow. And that doesn't mean we can sort of say, hey, life's fine because you don't have it today. We have to think head towards tomorrow for our regulations. The second point is, I'm going to come back on the, oh, God, we're all going to be ruined because nobody's going to have any jobs tomorrow bit. I think that is complete nonsense. And there is, you know, technology will hurt people. Okay? One of the, and Uber's a simple micro example with taxi owners. Technology and jobs is a macro level one, and maybe all university professors will be out of work in 3 years' time because all our students will be streaming in classes from, Larry Summers in Harvard and Paul Krugman at Princeton. So I'll be out of a job and I'll be on Freelancer looking for some odd jobs and perhaps fixing some doors. History shows us that it is positive sum. History also shows us that more jobs will be created than are destroyed over the longer term. The world, or the developed world, has been an amazing job creation machine for at least the last 200 years. It has made far more jobs than it's destroyed. That includes in recent times. People forget, back in the 1960s, most women in Australia did not work. Now we have reasonable levels of female participation. I think it could be higher. But that's a whole bunch of new jobs that are being created. Where are the new jobs going to come from? That's always the next question. Stephen, you've told us the new jobs are going to appear. Where are they going to come from? I wish I knew, because I could become really, really rich by getting there first and investing in those industries. But history over the last 250 years has shown us they will come. But we can't predict where in advance. But some people will lose in the short term. And the question for us as a society is, how do we make sure those positive sums get spread around?
I think we've just gone to swap sides in the debate.
Almost.
let me turn it over to questions from the audience. So one of the really striking things about peer-to-peer is the exploitation of reputation and information that was previously hidden. One of the questions is, where else can we use this model? For example, in the public sector.
I think it's interesting, and when I was in government in the U.S., this is a topic of discussion because, you know, people's expectations are rising. You know, they don't discriminate and say, you know, I expect a different level of of speed or efficiency because you are a small business or you're an education institution or you're a government. People expect the same level of speed, whether they're, you know, on, you know, BBC or Amazon or YouTube. And so that's a test for government, is that you have to make sure over time that you press a button and you can reach somebody or you get an answer or you are able to provide feedback. And so I think, like, in the, I can't speak authoritatively about what's happening here in Australia, but in the U.S., they've brought in a lot of, you know, really great innovators from Silicon Valley to try and refashion the U.S. government, which will probably take 312 years. But basically, it is inconsistent right now with how people are living the rest of their lives. It's too slow. It's too burdensome, particularly young people. I learned this from political campaigns. You know, if a young person couldn't find out in a minute, maybe even less than that, how to register to vote or where to get information, it was hard to ever get them back. You lost them. And so with government right now, I think the bar, and I think this place where government, they need to obviously figure out regulations that foster innovation and competition and job creation. But just from a service standpoint and boosting confidence and that customer experience, they have so long to go. But again, I think if they fall, I'm getting a little bit on my soapbox here, but if they fall too far below the private sector, and they're already really far below, you know, that's going to continue to make people skeptical, I think, and erode trust.
I think this question touches on the deep origins of peer-to-peer. If you think about it from the point of view of a computer scientist, peer-to-peer has no center. Right? Internet protocol doesn't have a platform. So the question is as follows. What do the speakers think about peer-to-peer economic exchanges that are truly distributed, maybe even with no money? Now, this is, I think what we're now touching on is maybe the Bitcoin, maybe something non-monetary. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, so I don't know how many of you actually know what Bitcoin is, the network as opposed to, or the blockchain as opposed to Bitcoin, the currency. And a lot of the press you see out there talks about BTC, which is the currency of Bitcoin, which goes up and down in value. But effectively, there's been a breakthrough with Bitcoin in solving a particular problem in computer science called the Byzantine Generals problem, which is basically, in layman's terms, if I have four generals and the four generals want to attack a city, and the only way that the generals, they all have to attack at the same time, the city, in order for this attack to be successful. But the only way they can communicate with each other is by sending a messenger, and the messenger has to go to the city, who, of course, will capture or substitute, you know, and so forth. So it's a solution to that particular problem, which is how do you get consensus in a distributed fashion, right? And in the case of Bitcoin, it's consensus over who owns what. It's a distributed asset register, right? There is no trusted third party in the middle. There is no bank. There is no government. It literally, there's an algorithm which all the parties who are actors in this network can participate in, who reach consensus on something, right? And, you know, over time, people have come up with all these really neat applications of using the Bitcoin network to do other things. They've done crowdfunding. You can now, you know, there's algorithms to crowdfund using the Bitcoin network. There's algorithms to issue shares and take in equity if it was legal in countries to do so. There are ways in which people can issue dividends, deliver interest. There's social welfare policies over Bitcoin. So there's wealth redistribution in terms of taxation and income supplementation. And people have figured out how to build marketplaces using the Bitcoin network that don't use a freelancer in the middle or an Uber in the middle, where literally the people can actually go and reach consensus over the reputation of people and the transfer of money to people. So, you know, yeah, it's pretty exciting, and there's a lot of innovation that will happen there. And, you know, this is one of the many things that keeps me up at night.
Matt Barry, CEO of Freelancer, ending that discussion on how to regulate the peer-to-peer economy. The other participants were David Plouffe, Senior Vice President of Policy and Strategy for Uber and former political strategist for President Obama. Stephen King was the voice you heard flying the flag of the regulator. He's Professor of Economics and Co-Director of the Business Policy Forum at Monash University in Melbourne and Chair of the WA Economic Regulation Authority. He's a former member of the ACCC. That event was moderated by Jim Minifee, Productivity Growth Program Director at the Grattan Institute, where tonight's discussion took place. Thanks to the team this week, producers Sasha Fagan, Karin Zivanovits and Ian Coombe, and technical producers Peter McMurray and David LeMay. Until Monday, bye for now.
Thank you. On Jazztrack, you'll hear music from the bebop era, recorded by the Dial label in the 1940s, and the feature of a recent 9-CD box set. Also, Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea in concert from 1978, and three differing Italian-led recordings. That's on Jazztrack with me, Mal Stanley, as audio on demand anytime at the RN website.